fiscal policy is so much more powerful. I mean, when you run a $2 trillion deficit, this is money that goes into people's pocket that recirculates then as it gets spent around. And fiscal was always a sleeping elephant. And monetary doesn't work. We saw that in the 2010s, right? Once you wake up the elephant, then you start to see things get interesting. It may be at the point where typical emerging market finance problem, you get into these inflationary spirals that are very common in Latin America. So we may be at that inflection point in that quote by Hemingway, that the gradual part is over and maybe we get to the all at once part now.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show, but for now, Mantra, thanks for making this episode possible. All right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of On the Margin. Today, I am joined by repeat guest Vincent Deloart. Vincent, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. And you must be doing excellent as well, because Vincent, I got to give you your stripes here. You were on the program about a year ago. And if you rewind the clock back, the title of that segment is that inflation is not going back to 2%. And obviously, it might still be a little bit early, but I think you can pretty safely claim victory, especially with the last 3 months of CPI accelerating. And before we, I want to, you know, ask you to explain for listeners who might have missed that interview, what you saw back then and what your prognosis on inflation is now. But I thought that was pretty interestingly summed up by this chart that you tweeted out. So maybe I'll just share this and sort of use this to kickstart the conversation, where we're looking at a chart of cumulative flows of treasury bonds, TIPS, and gold ETFs starting back in 2021, which was the last time we had a sub 2% inflation print. And as you correctly point out, treasuries ETFs took in $290 billion, TIPS took in $0, and gold ETFs lost $20 billion in assets. So can you talk to us a little bit about what gave you the confidence back then to make this call, and how does this chart really tell that story?
I've been in the secular inflation camp for a long time, really, since COVID. I would say almost before COVID, I had the view that, you know, I think people think the norm was what they lived through, which is an extraordinary period of disinflation from basically the early 80s to 2019. And if you're a student of history, you realize that this is not the norm. This was the exception. And this was driven by very unique factors. I think first and foremost was with the China shock. I mean, that's really what helped with inflation the most. Cheap goods towards the end of the period in 2010s, you had both your boomers and your millennials working at the same time, which lowered dependency ratio and increased society's ability to save. So you had really an abundance of goods, of labor, and of capital. And that's what really kept inflation down. And that's what allowed central bankers to come up with that 2% target, which is something that did not exist before the early 80s. So my view that was that it was always going to break. And I think COVID accelerated that break by bringing upon this kind of fiscal endgame or government spending wrecking ball, where you see, structural deficits of 7% of GDP when you're at full employment. And, you know, if you've been to emerging markets, which I do a lot, I do a lot of traveling to Latin America, you know, we've seen this movie before. I mean, if your government is going to spend, 7% of GDP when the economy is working best, your trend growth is about 2-3%. You need inflation to be around 4% to prevent the debt from skyrocketing, right? I mean, it's basic arithmetic here. This is what I saw for a long time. Last year was a bit difficult for me because we had a lot of really positive tailwinds for the economy. I mean, China reopened, but did not stimulate demand, stimulated supply instead, supply chains cleared, retailers had a lot of excess inventories that they discounted out. We had also 4 million workers that, you know, crossed the southern borders. So for a bit, it looked wonderful. This was the soft landing, like Powell's nailed it, right? We're going to go back to 2% and do that without a recession. This was kind of the consensus in, let's say, September, October. And Powell fed that narrative. Now, I think what Powell should have seen was that this was genuinely transitory. This was because of base effect in commodities. This was because of this China shock, but the underlying inflationary forces were still there. And I think that's what we've been dealing with in the past 3 months.
So let's talk a little bit about some of those factors. So basically, to sum things up, is there was this almost Goldilocks scenario that we had over the last 40 some odd years of just an enormous amount of labor. Maybe part of that is population based. Maybe that's partially economies were actually humming along, and also things like globalization, right? The U.S. and developed economies got to borrow from low cost labor pools, and that all led to this sort of Goldilocks environment of a little bit inflation, but not too much, and decent growth. And maybe that was always destined to break or not be the sort of status quo. And COVID really accelerated things. And now we're in this weird sort of economy where the US actually has the profile of an emerging market where, yeah, we've got steady growth, but we're running 7%, you know, of GDP deficits, which does not necessarily feel sustainable. So the question is, you know, Vincent, where do we go from here? Because the market, which I think over the course of the last year, this disinflation narrative that was taking center stage, you know, week over week, we were watching inflation prints trend down. But these last 3 months, it's been a pretty stark trend in the opposite direction. And this is around the period of time where people tend to look back at the 1970s and the 1940s. Where there was stop-start inflation, and certainly in the 70s, the second bout of inflation that we got was even much worse than the first. And so I guess my question to you is, you know, where do you see inflation trending from here?
My hope is that we stay where we are. I actually think we're not in a bad spot. This is really the, I would say, the Goldilocks scenario. I mean, that's one of the things that differentiate me from some of the other kind of inflationist hawks that typically, you know, it very rapidly deteriorates in, sell everything and buy some gold and, you know, kind of end of the world type of scenario. They're going to debase the dollar. And, maybe it's because I've seen emerging markets, you know, life goes on. Like if you Brazil in the 90s had terrible inflation. I mean, life goes on. People have their jobs, they raise families, and Brazil was a bad case. I'm not saying we're going to go Brazil. I'm hoping something more like maybe the what was called in France, les 30 glorieuses, the 30 glorious years of high growth, high and relatively high inflation between 1945, 1975. So if we can stay at around 4 or 5%, 3 to 5%, I think that's kind of the range where we are. 2% is probably the floor for inflation. And, you know, we stabilize at a 3-5% range. There's nothing inherently wrong with that range. I mean, the 2% target is some arbitrary shackle you put on yourself. And I think it's very context dependent. If you have a highly indebted society with high inequalities where, you know, the old own most of the assets and the young are really running behind, a period of high inflation can actually help with a lot of these problems. As long as it stays. I mean, the problem with inflation, of course, is there's a self-reinforcing loop, right? Inflation is inflationary, right? You get the expectation gain. But if we can keep where we are, I think that's fine. We can do that for 8-9 years, and then I think we come out in a much better place. I mean, already one stat that I found fascinating is that the market value of privately held debt as a share of GDP is the same as it was pre-COVID. So all words are important. It's a market value. So you have the interest rate shock. You know, obviously the market value has come down because of interest as a share of nominal GDP. Nominal GDP has gone up like crazy. So the denominator has increased. And then privately held, the Fed has bought a lot. So basically what I'm trying to say is we've been able to run these massive deficits without really adding to what matters for debt sustainability, which is the private market value of debt, the privately held debt. So this deleveraging, in my opinion, is working. What could derail it would be, of course, another oil shock. If we go back to the 1970s analogy, and it feels very relevant today, is okay. One way we could get from that 4% inflation to 9% inflation, which gets really problematic, is if we see oil prices go to $200 a barrel, and then that feeds into core CPI, and then we have a much worse problem. I think that the answer here is mostly geopolitics. And then the other thing that could get us there would be if the deficit keeps exploding higher. I think now we are on that really the edge, right? We're walking on the very narrow edge, but we could tip on the other side where the deficit starts to grow faster than nominal GDP growth, and then you get into this kind of fiscal dominance problem, the issues that, you know, are so common in Latin America. But I don't think we're there quite yet.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions into Web3. So you guys have heard me talk about Larry Fink talking about tokenization. You've seen the clips on CNBC. You know that Larry and BlackRock are very, very excited about this idea. And the reason for that is they're looking at these trillions of dollars of off-chain real world assets. They want to digitize those and bring them on-chain, which is going to be a massive opportunity. But in order to do that, they need a compliant L1, and that's where Mantra comes in. Mantra's been steadily climbing the ranks and now stands among the top four RWA projects on CoinGecko, which is representative of its rapid growth and influence in the tokenization space. Mantra's built using the Cosmos SDK, so they have some very cool stuff out of the box. They've got IBC interoperability. They also leverage CosmWasm smart contracts. Very cool design from an architectural standpoint. The next phase on the blockchain's testnet is Hongbai, so that's launching soon. So if you're a dApp developer or something like that, there's a lot of very cool opportunities for you. And I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of the show notes. I don't know that I sent you. Thanks very much again, Mantra, for making this possible. And again, guys, click the link at the bottom of the show notes. So I want to ask you about that. And I've got a bunch of follow-up questions for you on the whole idea of fiscal dominance. And we had an interview for folks who are listeners of On the Margin. I did a two-parter with Lynn Alden and Luke Grohman that you should go back to.
It was excellent, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. But I have a question for you on the whole geopolitics front, because obviously we're recording this on April 19th. So just last night, there's been escalating tensions in between Israel and Iran, and Iran had a sort of a drone airstrike which was aimed at Israel. A lot of it was thankfully thwarted. And last night, it seems like Israel returned the favor, albeit just based on the headlines. Caveat, I'm not a geopolitics expert here at all. I read the Wall Street Journal, and that's about all I know. It seems like it was a strike that was intended to sort of appease the domestic base of Israel that needed to see some amount of retaliation, but you know, they're not trying to escalate everything. Things. So it seems like things are relatively constrained. It also seems like, you know, Iran, the sort of lever that they have to pull is they could always close down the Strait of Hormuz, which something like 25% of oil in the world ends up flowing through. So people always get a little bit spooked and concerned about that. But Minsa, I would just be curious. It feels like we can't just ignore that. That has a huge impact on markets, especially if people get spooked about higher oil prices. But also, this is one of the things that it just feels like it's extremely hard to have alpha on. You know, you always get markets guys that weigh in on geopolitics, and oftentimes they get it very wrong because it's just not their area of expertise. Like, how do you, as an analyst that, you know, sort of focus on markets, how do you weigh the impact of geopolitics when it's this extremely, you know, thorny, difficult area to have any sort of edge on whatsoever?
I think you have an important distinction you can make. It's between events where, as you mentioned, there is no alpha. I mean, I don't have a direct line to the Iran Revolutionary Guards or the Netanyahu War Cabinet. And I can tell you my opinion, which, by the way, is the same as yours, probably because we read the same thing, which is, we're getting closer to the edge, but everybody's being very careful as to not get there, right? I mean, the Iranians kind of downplayed they said, they didn't hit our target. And so it looks, again, this sort of kabuki theater, making the distinction between events and trend. Events, no edge whatsoever from really anyone other than foreign policy types, which I'm not. But trends, I think you can reasonably bet on that. And I think, objectively, we've been in a trend of increasing geopolitical risk and increasing tensions. And maybe we can put the beginning of that when the U.S., even invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, which turned out to be horrible mistakes, and then had to withdraw, and that created kind of vacuum of power, the sense that, you know, the U.S. Was not going to enforce the global geopolitical order, and that emboldened countries like Russia, like Iran, like China, who have somewhat legitimate claims against the U.S.-led order to be more bold and take action. And we've seen this pattern of escalation. I mean, you know, we had this kind of low-grade war in the Donbass for 10 years, and then, you know, Russia was never supposed to invade. Then it invaded. Then it was supposed to win 3 days, but it did not. Then we, you know, and if you see with the Ukrainians, right, first we were never going to help them, then only money, then only advisors, then only this type of weapon, and now we're talking about, you know, like fighter planes. I mean, there has been this steady escalation, strikes inside Russia, Russia using these supersonic missiles, the countries, you know, same thing with Israel, and then the October 7 terrorist attack. You know, like now it looks like they're going to invade Rafah. So there is this general trend towards escalation. And I think you can, that justifies being broadly overweight what I would call the chaos assets. The chaos assets would be things like US dollar cash, gold, and either oil or energy producing companies. Because in this environment, you don't know where the hit is going to fall. For now, there's two hotspots, right? Russia, Ukraine, and Iran, Israel. Maybe it's going to be a third one with China. We don't know, but the odds that something bad happens are certainly much higher now than they were 10 years ago.
Mm. Okay, so I want to ask you about this fiscal dominance thing, but you just reminded me of something else. I would be curious what your opinion here is on the dollar or the DXY. So, you know, one thing that we've started to see is, for instance, the USD JPY cross has started to run away again. And it looked like it peaked a couple of months ago. And now I think we're at something like 155, you know, back to all time highs, essentially. And you're starting to see whisper. I think I saw something out of South Korea and Japan start to say, hey, maybe we should do something about this, essentially. And there is this historical precedent of when the dollar appreciates too much relative to especially U.S. allied currencies, then we do something like the Plaza Accord, where there's a sort of systemic deleveraging of the dollar. We devalue it a little bit relative to other currencies, and it serves as an injection of liquidity to markets. It's good for the U.S. exports and the economy, et cetera. And I think this is maybe a little bit early for this call, but, you know, you're starting to see whispers again of, you know, wouldn't it be nice if the dollar was just a little bit weaker here? That would help out markets pretty broadly. So I don't know if you have an opinion on the dollar or even some sort of global coordination from policymakers on trending towards a weaker DXY.
I've been long dollar cash for 8 months in our recommendations to clients, and that call has worked very well. I can see the scenario you're describing, but I don't see the conditions for it currently. I mean, at the end of the day, if we talk about this kind of age of geopolitical chaos, I mean, the dollar is still your best safe haven asset. I think you have also the economy points you in the same direction, right? Both the geopolitical situation and the economic situation points you in the same direction, where you see this extraordinary resilient U.S. growth, very high fiscal spending. One reason why I recommended staying in U.S. dollar cash 6 months ago is when the market was high on crack, pricing 7 rate cuts by the end of the year, and I knew this was not going to come. So as you push these cuts out, you realize, wow, the dollar was going to go through the roof. And you do see that. Right? We went from a situation where the Fed was expected to cut first before the ECB, and now it looks like the ECB is going to cut maybe twice before the Fed even does single cut. So all that is very dollar bullish. The dollar, I think, the U.S. has a much higher tolerance for higher rates than Europe, certainly. And when you look at the dollar index, you're really talking about that dollar-euro cross, right? I mean, it's, you know, 80% euro plus pound and krona and Swiss francs, so which derivative is euro. So if we talk about the dollar index, I think I would maintain that view. I hear you about the Plaza Accord and the fact that we have a crisis brewing in Japan, and I agree with that. I mean, You know, if you're Japan, you know, the price of copper has increased by 50% this year. The price of silver has doubled. The price of oil has increased by 300% in 3 years. I mean, you cannot run an industrial economy, and Japan is an industrial economy. It's not like Costa Rica or whatever. Like, you cannot do that with this kind of currency depreciation. So they have a problem. I agree with you. At some point, they will need to fix that. And it would be probably better to coordinate the way it was the Plaza Accord, but I do not think we are at that point. The U.S. is extremely distracted. You know, we have these two wars to fight. We have an election to deal with. We'll have a fallout from that election. So I can see this going back to this idea of the age of chaos. You could also see that in monetary, where maybe, like, you know, 6 years ago, it was the Sintra Pact, right? You could still get central bankers to come around the same table and talk and agree to coordinate. I'm not sure we can muster the same level of, I mean, there are just too many fires burning at the same time to really address an issue. And, you know, think about after November, what happens when, you know, you have a even more isolationist, even more kind of U.S. nationalistic type of policy. It's much harder to imagine this globally coordinated outcome, which I agree would be the best outcome for global growth.
Awesome. This is one of those things where it's extremely it's not even my opinion necessarily that there's going to be some type of Plaza Accord. Obviously, a lot needs to happen to that. And I agree that the U.S. has quite enough on its plate, I think, at the current moment. So, Vince, I want to get your take on, you know, we were talking a little bit before we got on here, and you were starting to talk around this a little bit when you were talking about fiscal dominance. But, you know, you gave me this great quote from, I believe it's Hemingway, that going broke happens very slowly and then all at once. And maybe I could use that as a jumping off point for you to describe, you know, just for listeners who might not be familiar with this concept of fiscal dominance. But can you just give us an overview of what fiscal dominance is and this sort of spiral effect that can happen in a fiscal dominance type situation?
Yeah, so it's about the respective role of fiscal and monetary policy. So in an age of monetary dominance, which is where we were mostly for the past 40 years, the central bank constrains the level of fiscal spending. And the best example you could see was the European debt crisis, when you had literally the ECB and the Troika go in Greece and shut down the ATM if these guys didn't cut public spending. This was the very embodiment of monetary dominance, 2% target, deficit rules, all that stuff. And we've been building this monetary dominance since the late great invasion of the 70s, right? You created all these tools to do that. And these tools, one by one, have been eroded: the independence of the central bank, the inflation target, and fiscal dominance is the other problem, when government spending overrides monetary policy. And you can certainly see signs of that in the U.S., like, when, you know, did we ever care about the quarterly refunding announcement before? I mean, no one knew what that thing was. And the financing decision of the Treasury, right, matters a lot more than the Fed policy. How much money there's in Treasury general account becomes like a hot topic. And I've always been a fiscal dominance guy. At the core, monetary policy just changes relative prices between, you know, the interest rate is the price of an asset in the future versus the present, and you play with that. You change the risk appetite. You do portfolio substitution effect. You change the relative value of stocks versus bonds. But at the end of the day, you're just moving one thing against the other. On the other hand, fiscal policy is so much more powerful. I mean, when you run a $2 trillion deficit, this is money that goes into people's pocket, that builds thing, that recirculates then as it gets spent around. And so I've always believed that, you know, the fiscal was always a sleeping elephant, if you want. And monetary doesn't work. We saw that in the 2010s, right? We kept having all these central banks trying to like do QE and, oh, inflation, nominal growth is going to pick up. It never picked up because, yeah, monetary is kind of lame. But once you wake up the elephant, then you start to see things get interesting. And we may be at the point where, which is typical emerging market finance problem where, okay, fiscal stimulates the economy, growth picks up, then rates start to come up. As rates go up, your deficit starts to increase. The deficit, in my view, sends back money into the economy. A big part of the increase of the deficit in the past 3 years is just higher financing costs. Now, typically, the government addresses that by financing at the short end, which makes the problem worse because you shorten the maturation of the maturity of your debt. So you have to roll it over and your interest expense keeps creeping higher. Your deficit keeps creeping higher. Your growth keeps accelerating and you get into these inflationary spirals that are very common in Latin America. And it feels in recent weeks like some market action is I think, trying to price out this scenario with long-term treasury selling off, inflationary assets picking up, and people starting to talk about, raising the inflation target. So we may be at that inflection point in that quote by Hemingway, that the gradual part is over and maybe we get to the all at once part now.
I've started to see this as a theory pop up a little bit more. And Warren Mosler has been saying this for a long time, but you've got recent converts of this idea, even from guys like David Einhorn, which is this odd combination of a very large fiscal deficit, but also raising of rates, that could actually be inflationary and accelerate inflationary as opposed to deflationary. What do you respond to this theory that higher interest in this particular environment actually could be a little bit inflationary?
In general, of course, I believe in the normal laws of normal economic laws. General, raising rates slows the economy and you don't slow inflation by cutting rates. Otherwise, the Turkish lira would be the strongest currency in the world, and it's not. But you have these extreme outcomes that can happen. And I think economists kind of disregard them because they're the exception. But once in a while, you get into the exception. I've seen it in Argentina. The traditional remedy in Argentina is, raise the interest rate, right? The currency is falling. So the inflation is very high. So the IMF comes in and tells these guys, they raise the interest rate to 50% in Argentina. What does that do? That just means that whoever owns Argentinian bond gets more money. You inject more money into the economy. And this is basically the story of the macro years. The crisis keeps getting worse, even though they're technically doing the right thing. So is the U.S. at the Argentina point? Maybe not, but we have a lot of circumstances that the inverted yield curve, for example. By and large, people's liabilities are locked at the long end, right? I'm in my house. I'm going to flex the fact that I have a sub 2% mortgage here. Companies also issued a lot of very cheap debt in 2021. You saw Apple issue some 50-year bond. Duration of bond indices has increased. And then the liabilities are the long end and the assets are the short end. Like I have a lot of course, assets in money market funds and I'm earning a nice spread in a way that, Yellen is paying my mortgage at this point. I'm earning 5.5% on my cash and I'm paying 2% on my mortgage. So the more rates go up, the more I make money on that spread. And I think a lot of companies are in this position. The big tech companies certainly are. Apple has positive interest income. Like usually, your EBIT is higher than EBT, right? But in this case, interest is no longer an expense; it's an income. It's possible. I think the real solution, and the same goes for Argentina, is not to raise rates. Is really you need to cut government spending. That is the engine. At the end of the day, when we talk about this kind of MMT Mosler-like argument, it's because you have the government, the central government, injecting massive amounts of money into the economy. And if you take the MMT view, the private sector, the public sector deficit is a private sector savings. So that's what you need to cut. So I would actually agree that raising interest rates alone is not enough. If you really want to address inflation, you need to raise interest rates and cut government spendings at the same time. And I don't see that happen in the US anytime soon.
Whenever you know this topic of fiscal dominance comes up, there are two camps that end up forming. And in the one camp, they say, look, what we need is some form of austerity here. The US is basically writing cat checks that its butt can't cash. And the only thing that we can do here to stop this sort of doom loop spiral that it seems like we're standing on the precipice of is, it's very simple, right? It's to spend less money. And then there's this other group that says, well, historically, actually, that has a pretty poor rate of working. And at the end of the day, the U.S. for the, I would argue, vast majority of the time for the better, but sometimes for the worse, is that the political gridlock of spending less is basically impossible at this point. In fact, I think the only two bipartisan issues that exist in the U.S. right now are we don't love China and spend more money. So those are the only two things that basically everyone can agree on. So it just seems very difficult. And the other way outside of this imbalance that we find ourselves in is kind of what you were describing at the top of this episode, which is, you know what, if you're in one of these economies where maybe there's been a lot of financial asset inflation, but not a lot of wage growth, is you rebalance that a little bit and you grow wages, you know, in excess of, and basically it's bondholders that end up getting sort of smoked. And maybe there are some messy social consequences to that, but ultimately that acts as a sort of rebalancing. Where do you fall in, if you had to generalize, in between those two camps? I mean, how do you think this ultimately ends up playing out?
I mean, the economist in me agrees with the former, right? It's, you know, you just look at the math and, oh, well, that's easy. That's what you got to do, right? And the historian, and I think the historian matters a lot more than the economist, because we live in the real world, not an economic model, agrees with the latter part, which is, I mean, I think you can cut a little bit spending in nominal terms. And that's what I'm kind of hoping happens in the US. I agree with you on the consensus of like, you know, spending more money and all that. But maybe we can have a period where fiscal spending grows less than inflation, which is one of the reasons why I believe we should raise the inflation target, because that gives you leeway to play with that without having to, you know, I mean, we're not, boomers are very vocal and, you know, so they're not going to take, no one can take an actual pay cut. But, you know, if your wage or your pension increase a little bit less than inflation, that makes things easier. That's why I believe a high inflation target helps in the process. And then I absolutely agree with your argument on, I think Keynes called that the euthanasia of the renter. Somehow we need to coordinate a default or a nominal default, at least on debt. We need to reset. And this is something, again, going back to history. I mean, Sumer, Babylon, you had this debt jubilee in the Bible, Leviticus, every seventh Sabbath, so every 49th year, all private and public debts are canceled. And I think what these ancient civilizations understood, which economists do not understand, is that over long periods of time, wealth grows faster than wages. It's basically the argument that Piketty makes in Capital in the 21st Century. R is greater than G in your dividend cash flow model, right? Return on capital is greater than G. So over time, there is a segment of the population that the asset owners, and keep in mind that an asset really is a claim on somebody else's work at the end of the day. Like the value of my stock means that I can buy labor with it. So assets and debt grow faster and incomes. And you can do that when you have a low level of debt, that's fine, but you reach a point at which, you know, the amount of years it would take for the indebted workers to acquire an asset, whether it be a home or stock, becomes so large that society stops functioning. So for the ancients, it was about 50 years. And it seems about right. Like the last debt jubilee we had was the inflationary jubilee of the 1970s. This is what happened effectively in the 1970s with the debt jubilee. We reduced the real value of the debt by about 50% with high inflation. And then that paved the way for, you know, Reagan and Volcker at the time. After that, in the 80s, we could actually sustain high interest rates because of the real value of the debt had been written off by a high period of inflation. So I think that's what we need to do. That's what we're trying to do. And yes, that includes some level of pain to be inflicted in on asset owners. And I worry that the Fed, I think the Fed understands part of what I'm describing in terms of like letting inflation run hot and not killing the economy for the golden calf of the 2% target, which is, I think, very clear from their recent press conference. But I'm not sure that they understand the part where if we want the rebalancing to work, asset prices need to drop, because that's the problem. At the end of the day, we want people to be able to buy homes with the product of their labor. And if you do a chart of like home prices and minimum wage, you realize that, yeah, it takes, you know, maybe 10 times more work to buy the same house now than I did 40 years ago. And that is a major social problem.
Hello, hello, listeners of On the Margin. I've got good news for those of you who are in the crypto scene. Blockworks is bringing back Permissionless. We're going to be doing Permissionless 3. And this year we are heading west. So we're moving that out to Salt Lake City. That's going to be October 9th through 11th this year. We've got a phenomenal lineup of speakers for you. So we've got Balaji headlining. We've got Sriram Munib, Matt Hogan of Bitwise, Jan Van Eck. This one's going to be a blast, guys. And I saw many of you out in London for DAS this year, and I hope to see you out in Salt Lake for Permissionless. And because y'all are such faithful listeners, we've got, if you use code MARGIN10, you're going to get 10% off your tickets. Appreciate you all. Hope to see you out there.
Yeah, that's extremely well said. And I don't really, I think one, there's a whole segment of folks out there, and maybe you're in this camp and maybe not, but there's this idea of the financialization of the economy and that the stock market is the economy. And maybe that complicates it a little bit, because even just so much of the income that the US gets from taxes is based on the performance of the stock market. So
yeah,
that's a, it almost seems like the Fed has a lot of really difficult needles to thread. Even its dual mandate is difficult to balance at times. But find that needle that you just described of letting things run hot a little bit, having some inflation and wage growth, but also having assets fall at the same time while not crashing the economy. Man, I do not envy Chair Powell's job here one bit. So I wish the best of luck to him and also Janet Yellen, who's also in a difficult situation. I want to ask you about, because I'm looking at one of your research notes here that you sent over, wherein you describe how to invest for a recession-free future. And you know what you end up with is this very interesting recommendation of holding tips against TLT, which is sort of the synthetic break-even position. But I want to let you describe, you know, this idea of a recession-free future. I mean, what should listeners think when they hear that phrase? Describe a little bit what you mean.
So if you think about growth and inflation as a two by two matrix, like the four economic quadrants, you can have either high growth, high inflation, inflationary boom, which is pretty much where we've been for the past 4 years. Then you can have the best of all world for assets, which is disinflationary boom, high growth, low inflation. And then you get into the worst scenarios, the stagflation, where you have high inflation, low growth. And then the great recession type of scenario, or great depression, where you have low negative growth, negative inflation. The point that I'm making is that last quadrant is gone. Like, you don't have to worry about that anymore. We're never going to go there. We might go around between the top three at different times. And we have, since COVID, we had a period of stagflation, we had a period of inflationary boom, but you don't go back into this, I call that the dark side of the moon, the one where the sun never shines. In the same way that in the 2010s, you never really had the inflationary boom, right? I mean, we either had disinflationary booms, but that there was another dark side of the moon. And the driver for that, I keep going back to it, is fiscal policy, because at the end of the day, I believe everything is fiscal. In the 2010s, we had this fiscal restraint, early 2010s, and now we have the elephant has woken up. And when you have a deficit of 7% of GDP, you're not going to have a deflationary bust. Maybe you get stagflation. I think that's, you know, if things go back, you go back to like the 70s, right? Where even recessions are inflationary. And that's a very different feel for you know, when we picture recessions, I think our memories are carry the stigma of 2010, 2011. We imagine, you know, foreclosures. We imagine 10% plus unemployment rate. We imagine people defaulting on their credit card debt and things like that. I think the recessions of the future will feel very different. You'll still have wages go up during recession. You'll still see inflation go up during recession. And actually, I would argue you see that in Europe. I mean, most of Europe has been in recession for the past year, and yet the unemployment rate is at a 50-year low. Inflation is still above, running above target, and you see the cafes, the restaurants, the beaches, they are full. It's a very different vibe from the early 2010s. So that's the macro picture. And then the portfolio implication is what you describe. So typically, if you want to build kind of an all-weather portfolio, you have assets that fare well in each quadrant, right? So for inflationary booms, you want to own emerging market stocks or energy stocks. For a disinflationary boom, you want to own the NASDAQ, large growth cap. For stagflation, you want to own commodities and gold. And then for that last quadrant, the deflationary bust, that's where your long-term treasuries fit in. And my view is that, well, if we're not going to have this, why do we need the long-term treasuries for? You can just drop that out of the portfolio. It serves no purpose. It hedges against a risk that no longer exists. On the other hand, the real risk is going to be inflation coming out of control. Like we were talking earlier, maybe we have another oil shock. Maybe fiscal spending really get out of control. And maybe we have this kind of LATAM fiscal dominance scenario. So how do you hedge this inflation? With a TIPS, treasury inflation protected security. So if you have a long TIP, short TL, short long-term treasuries, you effectively synthetically long the break-even inflation rate. And that is that becomes a new edge for your 60-40 portfolio. And by the way, it has worked since COVID. I mean, I put the chart in there. I think that trade just returned about 60% with a negative correlation of the 60-40 portfolio. And I know some of your audience love Bitcoin, and I have a lot of sympathy for it. I also love gold. The reality is Bitcoin and gold haven't worked in terms of diversifying a portfolio. They had great performance, but they haven't diversified as steadily as being long the break even.
I wanted to end actually by asking you about oil in general. So one thing, so I think oil really to me is an interesting asset right now because A, it's one of these hard assets that you can't print in this world of debasement, but B, there's a geopolitical element to it. We talked a little bit about Iran and Israel, and generally, I think what you're describing is this sort of era of chaos that's happening right now. But B, oil is directly linked to inflation, and we know that people have differing opinions about this, but there certainly is an incentive from the incumbent political party to try to impact what the price of oil is, because that has a massive determinant on who wins elections. And guess what? We've got an enormous, extremely contentious election that's going to be happening in November of this year. And obviously, oil is well off the highs from the last couple of years, but it's started to rebound a little bit. And so that's why it's at this interesting nexus of basically, it seems like every single important issue, just in terms of both markets and geopolitics. And so I would just be curious, if you see oil trending in any one particular direction. I noticed that the U.S., we drained our strategic petroleum reserve back last year, and then there was talk that we were going to try to refill it this year, but that's been quickly disregarded, and that's not going to happen. It looks like we might sell it off a little bit more now. So yeah, I would just be curious, maybe we could end here just talking about your thoughts on oil writ large.
Yeah, in general, I agree with your assessment of the centrality of oil, because all economic activity is energy transformed at the end of the day. And whether we like it or not, hydrocarbons are still the main source of energy. And within hydrocarbon, oil is the most energy efficient, easier to transport, store, blah, blah, blah. So it is central to pretty much everything that happens in the world, really. And you see that in times of crisis. I mean, every major war has ultimately a driver in the oil market. Why did the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor? Why did the World War I Iraq? It's always about oil. So And I also agree with your statement that every U.S. administration has an overriding, you know, target on oil prices. You know, the American way of life requires cheap oil prices, and Americans know it, and they will vote against whatever president does not deliver on this. The question, though, is can we? I mean, surely Biden would want to see oil go back to, you know, 50, 60. I mean, not too low, right? Because, you know, the U.S. now is you know, the world's largest oil producer. We don't want to have, like, bankruptcies in shale. So I think also the optimal level for the U.S. has risen over time, which is another reason why I think there's kind of a floor on the price of oil. The question is, can we do much about it? As you mentioned, we've already emptied much of the SPR. U.S. shale production seems like it's peaking. If you look at your decline rates, they are increasing. I mean, it took a lot of the brunt for the past 2 years. Like, we went to 13 million barrels a day, which is remarkable. But I'm not sure that we can go much above that. And then you also have the international context, where it seems to me that Europe is certainly not booming, but there are tentative signs of recovery. German industrial production was better than expected. And I think China is closer to rebounding than it is to, you know, it's been 4 years since Evergrande missed a debt payment. So the cycle in China is probably closer to bottoming, which is maybe one reason why we see commodity prices firm around the world. I think you could see more fiscal spending in China. What I'm describing is a fairly resilient demand, a supply side that's constrained by OPEC cuts, by losses of Russian output, by technical difficulty drilling in the U.S. So it paints to me a picture of high commodity prices. Now, it may not be now. I mean, now you have this big geopolitical premium in oil prices. Mm-hmm. You know, probably $10 is, you know, tied to, you know, uncertainty about Iran and Israel. And I hope we're both right and this de-escalates. So I could see maybe oil take a breather. But going into November, it seems that oil will be a political problem, even more so than it is today.
Well, Vincent, I know we've got to start to wind down here, but, you know, we've covered an enormous amount of ground here, and I really appreciate it. Anything that you want to leave the listeners with, you know, we sort of covered your thoughts on secular inflation, oil, currencies, et cetera. But yeah, just any sort of closing thoughts for these, and then maybe we can plug Stone X a little bit and give folks a little bit of an idea of where to follow you or more of your work.
Maybe I'll end with a somewhat optimistic note. We've been very a downbeat, you know, predicting more geopolitical chaos, political division. But again, life goes on. This is an adjustment that has happened before. I think it feels scary because we haven't seen it for a long time. We're a lot more used to deflation than we are inflation. But it's a necessary adjustment. And maybe it's the fact that I come from Europe, where I've seen what happens if economies do not adjust and you fall in this kind of deflationary debt trap, then you end up with like 30% youth unemployment rate and people staying at their mom's house until they're 40 years old, and this sense of societal decay and economies going nowhere. All that we're describing is taking us out of this. And eventually, when the process runs its course, you end up in a much better place than if nothing had happened. So I'm going to be, you know, very new agey, very Californian here. You want to embrace change. I think there's a beautiful quote by Shakespeare. The things we cannot change, we must learn to love them or to embrace them. And I think this is where we stand. We must love instead of fighting this new era that's coming up upon us. Wow, that was deep. Beautiful. Now on the less spiritual part, so I'm the director of global macro for StoneX. I write weekly research notes. If you're a client of StoneX, well, ask your broker to be added to my list. Of course, we do roadshows, we do webinars. I try to get as much on podcasts as I can because I think it's really the venue for the most interesting conversations at this point. I mean, so clearly, I'm so much happier here than I would be on Bloomberg or CNBC. I mean, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Vincent Deluard, at Vincent Deluard, D-E-L-U-A-R-D. And if you go under my pinned tweet, there's a link to register for a free trial of my research. I think it's 2 months. And I try also to answer. I'm not a huge poster on Twitter, but I do watch it a lot. And I do watch my inbox. And I always like to talk with smart people. And I've met a lot of great people from Twitter, from podcasts. And I think we all get smarter as a result of this conversation.
Well, Vincent, I appreciate the kind words, and you heard it here at Bloomberg. We're coming for you. But I want to plug you because I think you're one of these rare people where it's very tempting sometimes when you're talking about something as broad as macro to lose the forest for the trees, so to speak, and come up with sort of complicated theories that might not end up panning out. I think your record of calling balls and strikes I will say, like, I've been following you for a long time, and you've been on this podcast before, and I know Jack's podcast as well. You've been very correct and have a real knack of getting to the heart of and synthesizing very complicated topics. So listeners, you know, if you're not a subscriber or don't get StoneX research, I'd highly recommend that you follow Vincent's advice here. And Vincent, this was a ton of fun, man. Thank you for coming on, and we'll have to have you back on sometime soon.
With pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Cheers.